Oh, you're gonna lock it? That's fine.
We're very happy to have you right here. We'll be talking about mathematical foundation of Orient.
Okay. I'm glad we have a nice small audience. Because this is a talk about Orientifolds, which is truly only for the devoted. So here's the outline of the talk. I'll start out with some motivation and the main mathematical themes and summarize the results. I'll make a brief comment on the worldsheet formulation and talk about space-time as a stack. Then I'll come to the main message for today, the formulation of orientifold backgrounds in a nutshell. And that will use some mathematical constructions which are unfamiliar to many string theorists, I suspect, although string theorists haven't shown up, so maybe this was irrelevant, but then I'll talk about those mathematical. I'll talk about some mathematical concepts that are used in this formulation. Then I'll talk briefly about self-dual fields, the result for the charge of orientifold planes. Comment briefly, if time permits, on consistency conditions for D-brains and orientifolds, and conclude. So this is very much a progress report of an extensive project that I've been involved with Jacques Dissler and Dan Fried. Our original goal was to give a K-theoretic formula for the Ramond-Ramond charge of orientifold planes, and we succeeded in a special case, which I'll mention at the end of the talk. But to give a general talk to give a general formula is quite non-trivial, and forces us to understand more precisely the mathematical foundations of how you write down orientifolds. There's a lot of formalism here, which I expect will be unfamiliar to many string theorists. So this talk is going to be of the nature of a broad overview, lots and lots of details I can't go into. So there are two motivations for doing this. One, for me, the main motivation are the proposed type 2 compactifications on a large four-dimensional space times a small internal space with all moduli stabilized. And an essential element in all of these constructions are orientifolds, and those are needed to evade various no-go theorems based on positivity of the energy. Now, to me, that's an extraordinary claim, and extraordinary claims merit extraordinary proofs, and if you actually examine carefully the claimed implementation, say, of the KKLT scenario, then at least I find many technical points which I think ought to be cleared up. I can't go into all those different technical points, but let me just give you one example. So people use the solvability of the Bianchi identities and equations of motion for the Ramond-Ramond field. So that's this equation here. G is the total Ramond-Ramond field strength. H is the Nevill-Schwartz 3-form field strength. So we want to solve D plus H on G equals the Ramond-Ramond current of the D-brain plus the Ramond-Ramond current of the orientifold planes. And solvability of this implies that the sum of these currents is trivial in D plus H cohomology. Well, that's indeed a necessary condition, but not a sufficient condition for tadpole cancellation. There are examples where the tadpole conditions are satisfied at the level of differential forms, but not at the level of integral cohomology. So that's one reason why we want to understand the Ramond-Ramond charge of orientifold planes at the K-theoretic level. Moreover, there are consistency conditions for D-brains and orientifolds, which have to be stated at the K-theory level. That's one motivation.
So you're going to be doing twisted K-theory?
Yeah. Well, here you go. The second motivation is that the mathematical formulation seems to be very tight. There are lots of different moving parts which all have to fit together in just the right way, whether as it falls apart. And so it's a very non-trivial structure, and it's been forcing us to understand more deeply two key mathematical themes. One is how to apply twisted, equivariant, differential, generalized cohomology theories together with the formulation of the theory of a self-dual field, which is quantized by a Pontryagin self-dual cohomology theory. So I'll explain some of what these terms mean later. So here is a summary of the results. They're actually quite modest results. Mostly we've been just trying to understand the basic formalism. But such as they are, this is what we can say at the moment. We have a somewhat cleaner formulation of the world sheet formulation of a general orientifold sigma model than I've seen before in the literature. As I'll express, we have a very concise and precise way of saying what orientifold spacetimes are. That's orientifolds in a nutshell. We have a definition of the Ramond-Ramond charge of orientifold planes at the K-theoretic level. It's a bit abstract, but we are able to compute that charge once we invert 2 in a special case. And finally, there are consistency conditions for D-brains and orientifolds. So let me begin by saying just a little bit about the world sheet formulation. This is not as trivial to formulate as you might think if you really want to formulate it for all Riemann surfaces, including the fermions and so on. If someone knows a reference, please let me know, because I can't find anything in the literature that really does it. Today I just want to focus on one simple question. What are the twisted sectors in an orientifold? This is something that's confused me over the years quite a lot. So I'll give you an answer. So let's review orbifolds. So supposing we have a sigma model. So it's based on maps from an oriented Riemann surface, sigma, into a Riemannian target space, Y. And that target space has a discrete group of isometries, call it gamma. So the sigma model has a global gamma symmetry, and we wish to gauge that symmetry. So what does it mean to gauge a symmetry? Well, in this two-dimensional quantum field theory, it means you replace the two-dimensional space-time sigma by a principal gamma bundle with connection, but it's discrete, so there's no choice of connection. And you replace phi, you gauge that, and that replaces it by an equivariant map. So an equivariant map is this. So sigma tilde is my principal gamma bundle. And an equivariant map satisfies the commutativity of this diagram. So gamma sub y is the action on y. Gamma sub sigma tilde is the action on sigma tilde. This being a principal bundle over sigma, the action here is fixed point free. Now, as I'll elaborate in the next section, what this does for you is define a map on the quotient spaces. The quotient on this side is sigma. Smooth Riemann surface. The quotient on this side is what's called a stack. For the moment, just think of it as a quotient y mod gamma. Okay. Now, our physical Riemann surface, sigma, can have in and outgoing boundaries, these red circles here. And if we restrict our principal bundle to one of the in or outgoing circles, we get a gamma bundle over the circle. Now, gamma bundles over the circle are classified by their holonomy. That's an element of pi 1 of the circle into gamma. That shouldn't be slash gamma. It should be comma gamma. Modulo conjugacy. And so those are just the conjugacy classes in the group gamma. Now, you can replace this gamma bundle by an equivalent bundle, which has structure group, which is the cyclic group generated by the holonomy. And this bundle can be very simply described. It's simply this equivalence relation, x with gamma to the n is identified with x plus 1, gamma to the n plus 1. And that describes a covering of the circle over the circle where the Deck transformation for, the holonomy as you go around once is brings you up to multiplication by gamma. This piece of gamma is a single circle, so there's a single Hilbert space in the covering theory. And if you figure out what an equivariant map restricted to the circle is, it's exactly the usual condition that we're very familiar with in formulating twisted sectors of orbifolds. Okay? So that's just recovering standard twisted sectors of orbifolds. Now what happens with orientifolds? With orientifolds, we now add a new piece of data.
Yeah, sure. Why do gamma sigma tilde have to be explained?
That's really crucial because, thank you for the question, because we're gauging a gamma symmetry. Okay, so to gauge a gamma symmetry means you replace the world sheet sigma by a principal gamma bundle. And a principal bundle means that you have fixed point free action. So that's why on this side it has, of course on this side it doesn't have to be fixed point free, but on this side it must be fixed point free. Yeah, that's very important. Any other questions? It's a nice small audience, so I mean, nice and informal. Stop me.
I won't hesitate.
Okay, go ahead. So, orientifolds. So now what we do is we add, with orientifolds, we add a new piece of data. We add a homomorphism from gamma to Z2 called omega, and we might as well assume it's onto, otherwise we're back in the world of orbifolds. And what this does is it splits gamma into the disjoint union of gamma naught, the kernel of omega, and gamma 1, the rest. And the idea is, again, you're gauging gamma symmetry, but now you're accompanying elements in gamma 1 by parity transformations on the world sheet. So how does the world sheet space of maps look now? Well, again, we're gauging the symmetry. So again, we have our principal bundle sigma tilde. We're gauging our maps phi tilde. So again, we have equivariant maps. But the new item here is sigma tilde is an oriented Riemann surface. And the action on sigma tilde is orientation preserving for elements in gamma naught and orientation reversing for elements in gamma 1. And that's all there is to it. That's the change. Okay. Now again, we can ask about twisted sectors. So we could restrict to an in or outgoing circle in the physical world sheet. And then the claim is that the holonomy must be given by the conjugacy class of an element gamma, just in gamma naught, the kernel of omega. And the reason is that you can again reduce to this piece of gamma, but that's topologically S1. But now the deck transformations on that S1 have to be fixed point free orientation reversing maps if they're in gamma 1, and there are no such things. So you can only have the fixed point free orientation preserving maps, and those are in gamma naught. And that's why there are no twisted sectors. And for 10 years I asked people, why are there no twisted, if you're gauging the gamma symmetry, why aren't there twisted sectors for the orientifold transformations? And I always get these complicated answers in terms of modular transformations on Klein bottles. And that doesn't seem to me a very fundamental reason. This is a fundamental reason. Now, you're not done here because you still have to make sense of the B field amplitude. And you see, this can be quite tricky because now the physical world sheet is unoriented and, in general, unorientable. And so what do you mean by the integral of a differential form on sigma? So, well, you have to understand the proper mathematical home for the B field and, indeed, the proper meaning of the integral. So our current thinking is that the B field is in some generalized cohomology theory, and this integral even depends on a choice of spin structure, and so it's actually quite subtle. What I can say at the moment is that that equivariance condition that I explained before is the same as the condition that the pullback by phi of a certain cohomology class W, defined on the next slide, is equal to W1 of sigma. So if B is a W-twisted form, it can be integrated. So it's W. So X, remember, is the quotient space, and W is in H1 of XZ2. So let me remind you of a general mathematical fact. A double cover, M tilde over M, of any manifold over another, is a principal Z2 bundle over M. That's it. That's what a double cover is. And those are classified by their holonomy, HOM of pi 1 into Z2. And that is simply the same thing as H upper 1 of Z2. So you should think of H upper 1 with Z2 coefficients as classifying double covers. Well, you see, given our orientifold data, we have a canonical double cover. We could divide out by gamma naught, and that double covers the division by all of gamma. So that's the class W. Okay, there's much more to say, but I'm going to leave the world sheet for now. So if there are any questions... then no. Okay. So let me say a brief word about space-time as a stack. I resisted this for a long time, but I guess it's really the right language. So remember what a category is. A category is a structure where you have a set of objects and a set of morphisms, and for each morphism you have two maps to the objects. So the picture is that you have an arrow from one object A to another object B, and then these two maps are simply the initial and the final point. And there's a composition of morphisms. So if we have two composable morphisms, F and G, then we can compose them to get a third morphism from A to C. Well, that's a category. There's some conditions, of course. I think you all know them. And we'll be focusing on groupoids in which all the morphisms are invertible. And we'll be viewing space-time as a groupoid. So that means the set of objects and the set of morphisms will be manifolds. So now there are two key examples to think about here. One is, supposing you have a manifold with an open cover, U alpha. Okay? Now you can construct a groupoid as follows. You let the objects be the disjoint union of the open cover, and you let the morphisms be the disjoint union of the intersections on the open cover. Okay, and then what are these two maps from morphisms to objects? Those are just the two inclusions. So if you have U alpha beta, you can include it to U alpha or U beta. And now you go home and think about it. Isomorphism classes of objects in this groupoid are the same thing as the points of a manifold Y. But you see, the groupoid remembers extra data about the covering. The second example to think about is that Y is now a manifold with a discrete group acting on it, gamma. And in this case, we can define a groupoid called Y mod mod gamma. And the objects are, again, Y, and the morphisms are Y times gamma. So here's the picture of a morphism. You have a point and a group transformation taking that point to another point. And so then P0 and P1 are the initial and final points. And isomorphism classes of objects in Y mod mod gamma are the points of the topological quotient, Y mod gamma. But this groupoid remembers extra structure, in particular the stabilizer group of points. Now, if you put these notions together, you get what is confusingly called in the mathematical literature an orbifold. Actually, the mathematicians had it first. It goes all the way back to Satake. But to avoid confusion, I'll call this thing I just talked about a Deline-Mumford stack. Technically, a stack is this kind of equivalence class of the groupoids, the kinds of groupoids I've been talking about. But in some of the math literature, what they call this an orbifold, but I won't. Now, yeah.
Satake called them V-manifolds.
V-manifolds, true.
Just renamed them to the orbifolds.
Absolutely, you're right. Yeah, thank you. Now, given a groupoid, or in any category, you always have a simplicial space. I need that for the next construction. We had our objects, we had our morphisms. Now you can let Xn be the set of n composable morphisms. So X2 is pairs of composable morphisms. So here's a point in X2. And notice you can make a little triangle. And a point in X3 is three composable morphisms, F, G, H. Notice you can make a little tetrahedron and so on. So using those X's, I can define a vector bundle on a groupoid, which we'll need later when we come to twistings of vector bundles. So what is a vector bundle on a groupoid? Well, first of all, it's a vector bundle over the manifold of objects. So for each object A, you have a vector space E sub A. Then it's an isomorphism of pullback bundles over the set of morphisms. And so that's complicated. Just think of this very simple picture. If you have a morphism from A to B, some morphism F, then you have an isomorphism of the vector spaces EA to EB, theta sub F. And then over X2, you have some compatibility condition on these isomorphisms, on these gluings. So now let's think about those two examples of groupoids. In example A, we had the groupoid given by a manifold Y with its open cover. I claim that a vector bundle on a groupoid in that case is nothing more or less than an ordinary vector bundle that you already knew about. Okay? Because think about it. So you have E over X naught, but X naught is the disjoint union of U alpha. So you have a little vector space over each of the open sets. And now you're gluing together over the space of morphisms, which is the set of intersections, right? So that's the gluing of vector spaces over the intersections. And then the compatibility condition on X2 is the co-cycle condition, guaranteeing that you glue together a coherent vector bundle. So in example A, we just get an ordinary vector bundle. Now in example B, if you think that through, you get a gamma equivariant bundle on Y. Okay, so we'll come back to that later. Okay, so now, orientifolds in a nutshell. We'd like to describe what is a type 2 orientifold spacetime in a concise and precise way. And our claim is that the following data is all that you need to specify it. And there'll be some terms that sound scary, and then I will try and explain some of them. Okay, well, we start with a spacetime X, which is a smooth Deline-Mumford stack equipped with Riemannian metric and dilaton. I've explained that. The orientifold data is encoded in a double cover, X sub W over X. I also mentioned that before. Then we have to choose the B field. Now, the B field is a little tricky. Once we've chosen the B field, we get something that we call a twisted spin structure. Once you have the twisted spin structure, you can form the fermions in the theory, the gravitinos and dilatinos, and you can formulate the Ramond-Ramond current. It's needed for both. Once you have the Ramond-Ramond current, you can talk about the Ramond-Ramond field. So let me just indicate a little more of what's involved here. So the orientifold data is the double cover I mentioned. The B field turns out is a geometrical twisting of differential kr of this double cover. Now, you don't know what that means. I'll try and explain some of that. But topologically, I can tell you right now, topologically, the way you classify a B field is a triple, T, A, and H, where T is an H-naught of spacetime with Z2 coefficients, A is an H1 of spacetime with Z2 coefficients, and H is in a twisted version of H3 with Z coefficients. Now, from this data, you can make the twisted spin structure, and the topological conditions for the existence of a twisted spin structure are these equations on the first and second Stiefel-Whitney classes of space-time. So they involve this T, W, and A. Remember, W is the data of the double cover, the orientifold double cover. The Ramond-Ramond current, then, roughly, is the current due to d-branes is in differential kr, twisted by the B field. And the Ramond-Ramond field, roughly, is a trivialization of the sum of the d-brane currents and the orientifold currents. And the difference between two such trivializations, the different kinds of Ramond-Ramond fields you can have given a Ramond-Ramond current, are classified by differential kr, which is, again, twisted. Okay, so that probably looked a little scary. So now what I want to explain here is that what we're doing is we're using several different generalizations of the notion of cohomology. Okay? So I want to just tell you a little bit about the various four generalizations of cohomology that we're using here and then combining. So what is cohomology? Well, I think you're all familiar with singular cohomology, or at least Durham cohomology. It's a functor from topological spaces to abelian groups. And, well, we need a notion of generalized cohomology theory, which goes back to the 50s or maybe even 40s. Similarly, equivariant cohomology, again an old notion. Twisted cohomology has in principle been around for a while, but has been rather popular in the last 10 years. And differential cohomology is really has come to the fore in the last 10 years, I would say. And then you have to put them all together.
By the way, it's 50s, maybe even 60s.
For which? Generalized cohomology?
K-theory is regarded as the first one.
I thought Bordism was the first one, and that would be Tome in the mid-50s. But Atiyah only recognized Bordism as a generalized cohomology theory, I guess, in the 60s. Yeah. Anyway, that was the hot topic in the 60s, in topology anyway. Okay, so what is generalized cohomology? Well, if you think about what you do with cohomology, you use various properties of naturalness and Meyer-Vira torus, and then it turns out there are other functors that satisfy those properties, notably K-theory. And the common feature of these generalized cohomology theories is the existence of something called a spectrum. So a spectrum is a space S so that your cohomology group associated with your space X is the space of homotopy classes from X into the spectrum. For example, if you're thinking about ordinary singular cohomology with integral coefficients, that can be defined as the homotopy classes of X into something called an Eilenberg-MacLane space. That's part of the spectrum. Now, for K-theory, the spectrum is very interesting. Now we let H be a Z2-graded Hilbert space, and we let F be the skew-adjoint odd Fredholm operators on that Hilbert space. And then K of X is by definition, I'm cheating a little bit, but just a little bit here, K of X is by definition the homotopy classes of X into that space of Fredholm operators. Now in physics, this has a very nice interpretation. What we should think of is a non-commutative tachyon. Imagine the B field's been turned on the spacetime X. And so in the open string field theory of a D-brain wrapping X, there's a tachyon field, and it's an operator, so it's a map from X into the Fredholm operators, and it can define a soliton. And the homotopy class of that soliton, the homotopy class from X into F, is the K-theory class. So that's the relation to tachyon condensation. And in this Well, non-commutative means it's mapping it to Fredholm operators, which is in the set of bounded operators which don't commute. And so in the when you make non-commutative open string field theory by non-commutative field theory by turning a B field on a D brain, then the fields become operators on Hilbert space. That's the non-commutative. So H here should be thought of as the universal Chan-Peyton bundle for brain anti-brain systems. So the spectrum is very physical and interesting in K-theory. Okay, so that's my first generalization. My second is equivariant cohomology, and we'll need a few flavors of equivariant cohomology. So the first is equivariant cohomology of singular cohomology, Hj, so gamma of X. That's defined in terms of something called the Borel construction. I'm not going to go into that. But I just want to mention that in some special cases, it's very simple. For example, if the gamma action on X is free, this is just the ordinary singular cohomology of the quotient space X mod gamma. The other extreme is when it's fixed, when gamma fixes every point of X, and then you see it's not the cohomology of X, but of X cross the space B gamma, which has a lot of cohomology, which tells about the structure of gamma, and so the cohomology is much bigger. Now, for stacks which are of the nature of this global quotient, y/gamma, the cohomology of the stack is the equivariant cohomology of the target space, so of the covering space. So when I've been talking about these cohomology groups of stacks, in fact, what I've really been meaning is equivariant cohomology. So some of my formulas look deceptively simple. Now, there are actually some special cases in equivariant cohomology that are come up again and again in this Orientifold story, so let me mention them because they're useful. So I mentioned that H1 with Z2 coefficients classifies double covers Y tilde over Y. What is equivariant H1 with Z2 coefficients? Well, it classifies double covers of Y tilde over Y together with a lift of the gamma action to Y tilde. The first equivariant Stiefel-Whitney class of Y is very useful. You know that the first Stiefel-Whitney class measures whether a space is orientable or not. What the equivariant one measures is whether it's orientable and whether the gamma action preserves orientation. Similarly, the second Stiefel-Whitney class measures whether Y admits a spin structure and there exists an action of gamma to the spin bundle. Now, another version of equivariant cohomology we need is equivariant K-theory. So now we think that H has a gamma action, and so now we can look at those Fredholm operators which commute with gamma, and we can define equivariant K-theory in terms of the homotopy classes of maps of Y into F sub gamma. And this is, again, very physical. This is just the statement that we have an equivariant tachyon field. So we have this kind of identity on our non-commutative tachyon, and that's a very familiar equation from the theory of D-branes on orbifolds. Now, in orientifolds, you need a new version of equivariant K-theory, which hasn't really appeared in the literature, which is the following. Now, again, H carries a, quote, representation of gamma, but now elements of gamma naught, those are the things that were orientation preserving on the world sheet, are linear, and elements of gamma 1 are antilinear. So it's not a normal representation. The gamma 1s have to be antilinear. But then the formulas are the same. So we call that omega k sub gamma, because remember, omega was this crucial piece of information, this this homomorphism to Z2, whose kernel is gamma naught, so that we can write gamma as gamma naught disjoint union gamma 1. Okay, so now, in the special case, when gamma is Z2, then what this kind of K-theory is was defined a long time ago by Atiyah, and it's called KR theory of the manifold Y with involution. For stacks, which are of the form of a global quotient, this K-theory of Y is what you would want to call the KR theory of the double covering stack X sub W. Okay, I don't know if KR theory of stacks has been defined somewhere in the math literature, but this is how you would want to define it, at least for this double covering. Okay, so that's the first two generalizations of cohomology theory. Now we're also using something called twisted cohomology. And again, you can give a very general definition of what twisted cohomology is, but I'm not going to do that. It would be too technical, but I'm going to give you two key examples to think about. Okay, the first example, very useful, is the following remark. Any cohomology theory, any generalized cohomology theory, E, can be twisted by a double cover. And my notation for twistings is tau. So supposing X tilde is a double cover of X, then we define the twisted cohomology, twisted E cohomology of X, to be the isomorphism classes of cocycles on the double cover, which are odd under the Deck transformation. So they're actually objects which live on the double cover and are odd under the Deck transformation, and that's the twisted cohomology of X. In example two, that's true of any cohomology theory. You can twist any cohomology theory by a double cover. In example two, I'm going to talk about a twisting of K-theory, and K-theory can be twisted by a gerb. And the idea here is that we replace our spacetime X by a groupoid which has X as the set of isomorphism classes. So instead of X, we think of a groupoid with objects, morphisms, two composable, and so on. So what's a twisting? Well, a twisting of K of X is a line bundle, L, over the set of morphisms, together with a multiplication on two composable morphisms. So here's a picture of X, of an element of X2. And so when I have F and G, which are composable morphisms, then I have a multiplication of the lines LF times LG isomorphic to L of FG. And then there's a compatibility condition on X3. So if you think about the very simplest example, so let spacetime be a point, and let the equivalent groupoid be a point slash slash gamma, then a twisting is the same thing as a central extension of gamma by C star. You see, what's the picture? You have X, you have one object, your morphisms are like this. So those are like group elements in gamma. Let's call them, in fact, gamma 1, gamma 2, and so on. Now, for each group element, you've got a line. Okay? That's exactly what you have in a central extension. For each element gamma, the inverse image here is a C star. That's what's sitting over here. And what I'm doing here is I'm telling you how to multiply those lines. That's converting this gamma tilde, this principal C star bundle, into a group. And the compatibility condition on three composable morphisms is the associative law for gamma tilde. So that's what a twist, this is the very simplest example of a twisting. So if you want to understand twistings, you start here. Now, recall, I won't flip back to it, but recall we talked about vector bundles on groupoids. I introduced that so that I could now tell you about twisted vector bundles on X with a twisting tau. So a twisted vector bundle on X is a vector bundle on X naught, not on X, on the set of morphisms X naught, which could be very different. And now an isomorphism not between the pullbacks on X1, but the, one of the pullbacks is twisted by this line bundle. So here's the picture again. If I have a morphism F from A to B, then my isomorphism between the fibers is between EA and not EB, but EB tensor that line bundle L sub F. So that's what a twisted vector bundle is. And again, there's a compatibility condition on X2. So the very simplest example is to take X as a point and then take your groupoid to be a point slash slash gamma, and a twisted vector bundle on a point then is a projective representation of capital gamma. In particular, if our twisting is a central extension gamma tilde, our twisted vector bundle on a point is a representation of gamma tilde. Now, from here, you have to go on and talk about twistings of KR of XW. You're probably getting tired, so I'll just tell you that what happens at this point is that in the multiplication, you get some extra complex conjugations. So in our example of a point, again, what we get is not a central extension, but a non-central extension. And then you're looking at representations of this non-central extension, and one little side benefit of this is it clears up something which is very confusing in the string theory literature, which is what is the meaning of discrete torsion for orientifolds. So discrete torsion for orientifolds is basically a projective representation not a projective representation of gamma, a representation of gamma tilde given by these kinds of non-central extensions.
So it's going to behave something like a dihedral group?
Yes, well, a dihedral group is certainly a non-central extension of Z2 times Z2. So in that sense, I certainly agree. Let me just say what this non-central extension gamma tilde is. So you see, now we have gamma tilde, which is an extension by U1, but it's not central. And what's the multiplication law? So the multiplication law looks like this. I guess I'm using C star instead of U1. Doesn't matter. So I want to multiply two of these guys. Well, the way I do it is I write Z1, Z2 times the cocycle of gamma 1, gamma 2, comma gamma 1, gamma 2, if omega of gamma 1 is plus 1. In other words, if gamma 1 is, that is to say, gamma 1 is in capital gamma naught, but I write Z1, Z2 complex conjugate cocycle of gamma 1, gamma 2. Gamma 1, gamma 2, if gamma 1 is in gamma 1. And now this C star is not quite central because of this extra complex conjugation. All right, so the fourth generalization that we need is differential cohomology, and I'm just going to be very brief on that. So differential cohomology is about abelian gauge theories. And if you think about the gauge invariant information in it, a generalized abelian gauge field, there are three pieces of gauge invariant information. First of all, we learned from Maxwell that there's a field strength. And that's some kind of differential form, the E field and the B field. Okay. Then we learn from Dirac that there's more to it. There's also an integral cohomology class in general. It's some cohomology class and a generalized cohomology theory. But that's not the end of it. We also learned from Aharonov, Baum, Wilson, and Atoft that there can be a flat field, not detected by the field strength, not detected even by the cohomology class, and that would be in some cohomology group with R mod Z coefficients. And now these three data are correlated, and the correct concept for how they're correlated is what's known as a differential cohomology group. I'm not going to give you the formal definition, but I'll give you two key examples. The first example is that of U1 gauge fields. So now the differential cohomology group is known as H2 check of X. It's the isomorphism classes of line bundles with connection on X. And these differential cohomology groups always have two exact sequences associated with them. One is the field strength exact sequence. So there's a map out to the field strength, which is a two-form in Maxwell theory, and it satisfies some integral quantization law. And then the kernel of that map, the flat fields, is this cohomology group. There's a second exact sequence where we map to the topological class of the gauge field, and that, in this case, would be the first Chern class. And the topologically trivial gauge fields are those which can be represented globally by one forms. Now, H2 check is the set of gauge equivalence classes of gauge fields. And so we don't get just one forms here, we get one forms modulo gauge transformations, which are one forms with integral periods. The second example is that of type 2A Ramond-Ramond fields in the absence of Ramond-Ramond current. And in this case, the Ramond-Ramond field would live in differential k0 of x. So again, there's a map out to differential forms. That's the total Ramond-Ramond field strength. The kernel of that map are the flat Ramond-Ramond fields, which is k minus 1 with r mod z coefficients. And then in our second exact sequence, we have a map out to the topological class, that's K-theory. And the topologically trivial Ramond-Ramond fields are those which can be represented by an odd form. And again, we're dividing out by large Ramond-Ramond gauge transformations. Okay, now what you have to do is you have to combine these four concepts together. Remember, they were generalized cohomology, equivariant cohomology, twisting of cohomology, and differential cohomology. And it's not easy. And obviously I'm not going to show you the details, but an important outcome of this is that you learn that the geometrical twistings of differential KR theory are themselves twisted differential cohomology classes in a generalized cohomology theory, which is a generalization of H3 check. The fact that that B is itself a twisted cohomology class really generalizes the rule that you probably know, that in an orientifold, the B field transforms not by the pullback under orientifold transformations, but with an extra minus sign from that orientation reversal on the world sheet. And what you discover is that the topological classes of these twistings, first of all, is an abelian group, and it sits in an exact sequence like this. So this is what I said before, the topological classifications of the B fields. There's an element of H0 with Z2 coefficients, an element of H1 with Z2 coefficients, and an element of twisted H3 with Z coefficients, the twisting by the double cover, the orientifold double cover. Remember I told you that any cohomology theory can be twisted by a double cover. So we have TA and H. What are those physically? Well, space-time, we can assume, is connected, so T is just 0 or 1. That's 2A or 2B. What is A? Well, A is some class in H1 with Z2 coefficients. Roughly speaking, this tells us when we accompany minus 1 to the F left with gamma in the world sheet formulation. And what is H? Well, H generalizes the familiar quantization law of the Nivo-Schwarz field strength. Okay, so that's the first part of generalized twisted equivariant differential cohomology theory. Now let me say a few very brief words about the second main element of our picture here, which is we have to use the theory of self-dual fields. Now let me just remind you, of the familiar paradigm of three-dimensional abelian Chern-Simons theory, which in modern language is holographically dual to a self-dual scalar field. So the picture is you have a Riemann surface, possibly with boundary, like a disk here that I've drawn, and you form a three-manifold, which is sigma times R. And you look at a Chern-Simons theory on that three-manifold, and you quantize that, and that's holographically dual to the chiral edge states on the boundary. How many people have seen that before? Good. One, two, three. Oh, boy. Okay, well, this is supposed to be reminding you of something familiar. Sic transit gloria mundi. Used to be something everybody knew. This construction of Chern-Simons holographically dual to chiral theories on the boundary can be generalized to any what's called Punchhagen self-dual cohomology theory. So just as an example, we could consider the self-dual field with a 2L plus 1 degree, a degree 2L plus 1 field strength in 4L plus 2 dimensions. The way we would formulate that is we would use a Chern-Simons theory in 4L plus 3 dimensions. And now there's a key observation about that Chern-Simons theory. Supposing you have your Chern-Simons gauge field, let's say it's topologically trivial, in 4L plus 3 dimensions, then you try and formulate this Chern-Simons action, and you notice something about the Chern-Simons action. It satisfies this identity. S of A1 plus A2 minus S of A1 minus S of A2 is A1 dA2. Well, that turns out to be the natural pairing in differential cohomology of A1 and A2. So what the Chern-Simons action is called a quadratic refinement of a certain bilinear form. Okay, you're a student of Singer, so you know this. Okay, good. So the Chern-Simons action is a quadratic refinement of the natural bilinear form on differential cohomology. And that turns out to be the key ingredient in defining a self-dual theory. It's always that you have to choose a quadratic refinement of some bilinear form. So when we apply it to the self-dual Ramon-Ramon field in Orientafault, we need an 11-dimensional Chern-Simons theory with an action that's roughly speaking something like this. Our Chern-Simons field is now in differential Kr of the 11-manifold. We multiply and we integrate in differential Ko. Now, in order to make sense of that integral, you know, in order to do any integral in a cohomology theory, you have to have an orientation. It turns out that there's always a canonical orientation, which I've denoted here, a canonical twisting or a canonical orientation, which is the twisting of KO check of XW. But A times A bar has a twisting, which is the B field plus the conjugate B field. And it's not trivial to say that these two things are equal, and that's where our twisted spin structure comes from. So this topological condition on orientafolds, on consistent, mathematically consistent orientafolds, comes from the existence of a self-dual field on space-time. So the first Stiefel-Whitney class of space-time is T times W, and the second Stiefel-Whitney class is TW squared plus AW. Remember, T is 0 or 1, 0 for type 2b, so these are. So look, so if you're in type 2b, T is 0, and so you see space-time must be oriented. If you're in type 2a, T is 1, and so space-time might or might not be oriented. It depends on the nature of W, on the nature of your orientafold group. Similarly, it might be spin or might not be spin. It might be pin, it might not be pin. These are the correct topological conditions to define an orientafold. Now, it turns out that the same conditions come up when you try and write down the action for the gravitinos and dilatinos in the 10-dimensional supergravity action. And again, the same conditions come up when you try to write down the world sheet theory with these twistings of K-theory. So it's probably right. So let me say very briefly a formula, a K-theoretic formula for the charges of OP plus minus planes. So now you put all these ideas together, and first of all, you can give a definition of the K-theoretic charge of an O-plane. And at least in one case so far, we can actually compute that. Namely, when we simply have gamma is Z2, when the B-field is what we call a universal twisting, which I won't define, but it's often assumed without stating it explicitly in the literature. And when the fixed point set of the orientafold locus, the orientafold planes, if you like, have codimension 0 mod 4 and are spin. Okay? It's just a special case, but already it's not trivial. So here's the K-theoretic formula once we invert 2. So it's the push forward, it's 1 half, the push forward of C of F over psi a half of Euler of nu. So what's going on here? So iota is the inclusion of the fixed point locus into space-time. The normal bundle is nu. Euler of nu is the difference of the chiral spin representations. Psi sub 2 is known as the Adams operation, and psi 1 half is its multiplicative inverse. And the C of F here is something called Bott's cannibalistic class, which is a KO theoretic version of the Wu class. And the proof of this formula involves the Atiyah-Siegel localization theorem. So I'm not going to say any more about it. But if you take churn characters, you now go into the, you lose torsion information, but you'd go into the world of differential forms. And what we find, kind of amazingly, it's a pretty calculation, is the formula that you see in the literature that was derived by Morales, Skruka, and Cerone for the charge of orientifold planes. Now, Skruka and Cerone didn't actually tell us whether they were calculating the charge of OP plus planes or OP minus planes. They didn't seem to bother about that. And from the K-theoretic formalism, we think that it should be a plus or minus sign here. But I have to caution you about something that's been bothering us for over a year and a half, which is we don't see any way to get around that in the K-theory formalism, but it does contradict papers in the literature by Mookie and collaborator and Julia and collaborator. And Mookie's argument is pretty good. It's sort of a corollary of Witten's paper on compactification without vector structure. So we've been puzzled. I don't know what to say. There are also simple worldsheet arguments. I've consulted various experts on orientifolds of conformal field theories, and they seem to think that, yes, the charge of an OP plus plane should just be minus the charge of an OP minus plane, including gravitational corrections. This is contradicted by Mookie Suryanarayana and Julia Labardere, but seems to be predicted also from this K-theoretic point of view.
So that plus or minus is the same plus or minus?
That plus, yeah, the plus and minus are the same plus and minus, exactly. Exactly. And, so the K-theory formalism produces this formula beautifully, together with the factors of 2, the right factors of 2. So you can see why we have to invert 2 in K-theory in order to write such a formula. Also that we have L of R over 4 and things like that. But so that's a puzzle. Okay, very briefly, consistency conditions for D-brains. Well, you see, supposing we have a D-brain world volume, W, embedded into space-time, where the world volume is invariant under gamma, then the gauge bundle on the D-brain gives some element of twisted equivariant or K-theory of W. And to compute the Ramon-Ramon current, you have to push forward that K-theory class into the K-theory group of space-time. But the Tolm isomorphism theorem says that the twistings have to be related. So if you identify the normal, the tubular neighborhood of the D-brain world volume with the normal bundle of the D-brain, then there's a projection from the normal bundle to W. And Tolm isomorphism says that the pullback of the twisting of W plus a canonical twisting of the normal bundle is equal to the B field. And that turns out to, you see, the twisting of W tells you things like whether you have an ON gauge group or an SPN gauge group, and it tells you other things too. So this reproduces the familiar rules for when D-brain carries as SO or an SP gauge group, but it actually says much more because people tend to do things like have the D-brain world volume coincide with a component of the fixed point locus, and then they also assume its spin. So there are all sorts of things which have to be generalized compared to what you find in the literature. So conclusions. There's lots more to say. This has been very superficial, broad overview. A lot of work has to be done. I mean, I don't want to pretend that we understand everything. We are confused about lots of things. There are puzzles that need to be resolved, some like this relationship to Witten's paper on compactification without vector structure. This is something that's been bothering us for over a year and a half. There will be clearly further consistency conditions for D-brain anomaly cancellation, but we have to get these other more elementary things first before we can address that. And it would be really interesting to look at examples of string backgrounds, KKLT realizations and things like that, and examine, well, what do our consistency conditions say about the mathematical consistency of those models. I think it should be possible to include T-duality, and that will be interesting and non-trivial, but I'm pretty sure it ought to work. S-duality is a whole nother matter. There are things called OP tilde planes, OP tilde, OP hat planes, and all sorts of stuff which is predicted by S-duality, which seems a little difficult to fit into the K-theoretic formalism. So there's some very interesting puzzles there, as are the relationship to M and F theory. So that I conclude. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Any questions?
Too many questions.
Too many questions. Okay, well, I'll be here for the next two weeks.
Does this simplify at all if the only group acting was this orientation reversing Z2, if you didn't do the orbital folding?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Sure.
But I mean, even in that case, you would be faced with the puzzles such as the...
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure, sure. So, for example, our formula is just derived for that case, where gamma is Z2, right. I haven't tried to work out all the details for general gamma of the self-dual theory and so on. So a lot of our work, of course, that's where we started, and here I've been emphasizing sort of the conceptual foundations, so I've been talking about gamma, but indeed, yes, there are simplifications. In fact, Dan always tells me not even to think about gamma. Dan always thinks about it this way. He thinks, well, there's a stack which double covers another stack, and don't bother me with this gamma naught. You see, for me, this is equal to y/gamma naught. But Dan always just thinks of a single double cover, so that's like going to the case gamma Z2.
Right.
So he would definitely tell you, answer, well, this gamma naught is just irrelevant. You know, it just comes along for the ride. All the non-trivial information is in that double cover.
I guess my other question is that the formula that you had for twisted spin structure...
Yeah.
It's reminiscent of something, but I'm having trouble saying what it's reminiscent of.
Oh, well, I'll be very interested to hear that.
No, reminiscent of something in string theory, where people have...
I would be very interested. I don't know what it's reminiscent of to you, but there is a worldsheet version of this, and it has to do it has a lot to do with the following. From the worldsheet point of view, the way this twisted spin structure comes up, let me say a word about that. Is the following. So you see, we have our space-time y, and now we have an element a in h1 of y with z2 coefficients, h1 gamma of y with z2 coefficients. So remember, we're trying to gauge the gamma symmetry of a sigma model in here. And I told you that what this classifies is a double cover, y tilde over y, together with a lift of the gamma action to y tilde. So let's let rho be the deck transformation. So, this is a Z2 principal bundle. So the way you would try and formulate a theory in which your Ramondremont fields are twisted by A is you would try and write a type 2 theory where you have a maps of sigma into y tilde. Okay, and now you want to gauge
Well, you might think you want to gauge Z2 times gamma.
Okay, so if you gauge,
if you think of the Z2 as rho times gamma,
then you're not doing anything. You're introducing a double cover and then you're gauging it away. But what you can do in string theory is you can gauge, you can think of this Z2 as rho minus 1 to the f left. Now you're doing something. Okay. So, because remember that
gamma is gamma naught, and because we're doing an orientifold,
we're accompanying gamma 1 by omega. So now you're trying to, so the proposal is, well, okay, you now take an orientifold by this group of string theory on y tilde. But let's think a second about what that involves. Because, you see, what does the string theory Hilbert space look like? Well, it looks like H Nouveau Schwartz times H Ramond tensor, H Nouveau Schwartz on the other side plus H Ramond on the other side. Now, these are geometrical transformations, so there's no problem on the Nouveau Schwartz, right? There's no problem acting on the X mu and the psi mu. I'm thinking of the NSR formalism. But how do you act on the Ramond sectors? Well, you need a lift of this to the pin structure. And the point is that that rho and gamma might not lift to the pin bundle. So, in fact, that's exactly what happens when this cohomology class A times W is non-trivial. When A times W is non-trivial, you cannot lift. You cannot define an action of Z2 times gamma on the Ramond sector. What you can define is a central extension. Let's call it gamma hat of Z2 times gamma, a curly G hat. Okay, where the cocycle here is essentially given by the data of A and W. So now what I have to do is I have to put hats here. Okay? But now you're in danger, you're in real danger here, because you see, let's take an element like omega gamma hat here. If you're using these to generate a group that you're going to orientifold, but now that means that the group commutator is in the game. So now let's look at the commutator. Rho minus 1 to the f left, omega gamma hat, rho minus 1 to the f, oh, that's a rho hat minus 1 to the f left. Rho hat minus 1 to the f left is order 2, so that's the inverse. And now it's like omega gamma hat inverse. So that's equal to minus 1 to the f left, omega, minus 1 to the f left, omega, times rho hat, gamma hat inverse. Well, let me just, it's order 2, but I'll just call it rho hat inverse. Now you see, this is minus 1 to the f left plus f right.
We all like your screen.
Okay, so this is minus 1 to the f left plus f right. That's space-time fermion number. So you see, if this is equal to 1, you're dead, because you're projecting out all the fermions, and you're doubling the number of Ramond-Ramond fields. You don't want to do that. What that means, therefore, what you want is you want this lift here to be such that this is minus 1 to the f spacetime, so that these cancel. That's what the twisted spin structure is doing for you. So now I've just given you the worldsheet derivation of the twisted spin structure. And so it's very interesting. So you see, in on the world sheet, there's minus 1 to the f left omega, and this generates a copy of the group D4. On the other hand, when you have this A and you have W, you see, these generate a fourfold cover of Y, which has a Z2 times Z2 symmetry, which doesn't act on this pin bundle, but its D4 lift acts on the pin bundle. So there's sort of two D4s and you're taking a kind of diagonal d4. And for in order for that to work, so this is that now I'm sketching for you how it works for the gravitinos and dilatinos. And you find the same kind of structure is needed to write down the couplings of the gravitinos to psi bar to the fluxes, for example. So that's oh, that's interesting. So I can't get out of the screensaver. Okay.
Well, I'm more busy. Maybe we'll let the audience go.
Okay.
Thank you.